Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens when convicted killers have completed their prison sentences? And what else besides serving their time is required for them to be truly rehabilitated? Sabina Heinlein spent more than 2 years getting to know residents of a West Harlem halfway house, watching as they struggled to navigate an unfamiliar and often unwelcoming world after decades behind bars. Her subjects also still had to deal with their own guilt over their crimes, and after years of dreaming about being out of prison, they found the array of choices so overwhelming that even the simplest acts of everyday life left them paralyzed. Sabina Heinlein has written for the Iowa Review, the Brooklyn Rail, and Tablet Magazine. Her new book is called Among Murderers, Life After Prison. Sabina, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor.
So there are about 7,000 people released from U.S. prisons every year, and yet they are largely absent from the public consciousness. Can you talk about what made you want to look into their lives?
Well, I mean, I started a little bit from a different angle initially. I wanted to look at, you know, I was in grad school at NYU, and I wanted to look at what people in New York do who are unemployed, people who don't work, because it occurred to me, you know, coming from Germany, it occurred to me that New York is a city where everybody always works, and that's all people talk about, basically. So I was wondering, what do people do who don't work? And I did a little bit of research, and I came across those job readiness classes, they're called. And I started to visit the agencies that facilitate these classes. And it turned out that most of these classes are really for ex-cons, people who have spent, you know, different amounts of time in prison, some of them more than half of their life locked up. And so, you know, I noticed there's like five or six really big agencies in New York that have classes like that. And so I just, you know, started to visit those or, you know, try to get access, and I got access to those job readiness classes. And I just found it interesting, you know, how people are being treated basically like all this, as if they were all the same. And I started to talk to them in between classes, and I, you know, not surprisingly, they're all very, very different and have very different needs and desires and problems.
One of the needs you found, and I thought this was really interesting, was that although society is inclined to judge people harshly even after they have served their time, they have this kind of overwhelming need for attention and just like human relationships.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you've spent so much time behind bars, I mean, in a sense, if you've spent 20 or 30 years behind bars, this is where your family is. So a lot of people are being released, and, you know, their old friends have either died or they, you know, belong to what they said, the criminal element, and that's something they wouldn't want to reconnect with in order to not, you know, get on the wrong path. So they come out and they basically have no one other than, you know, the halfway house. I mean, in my case, my subjects were living in that halfway house in West Harlem called The Castle. And so they, you know, talked to each other, which is kind of ironic, actually, because parolees are not supposed to associate with each other, because I guess the logic is that if you associate with other former criminals, you're more likely, you know, to form a gang and to become a criminal again. But then, on the other hand, there's really nothing else or no one else to connect to, because people generally stay away from ex-offenders.
I was really interested to read that they don't typically talk to one another about the nature of their crimes.
Yeah. Well, one of my sources, subjects, Bruce, said, well, if you know how much time someone got, you know, 20 or 30 years, then it must be murder, because there's hardly any other crime that gets you, like, more than two decades. I guess, you know, child molestation or something like that might also get you two or three decades. But then, you know, murderers feel like they're still above child molesters for some reason. Yeah.
So talk about, because I know that you met a number of individuals. How did you choose your three subjects, Angel, Adam, and Bruce?
I interviewed people for at least 6 months before I finally found Angel. I at that point, you know, I was thinking about the mundane problems people encounter after serving long prison sentences, and so I was looking specifically to find someone who had committed a significant crime, and I went up to Albany to report for the Brooklyn Rail on the Albany Advocacy Day, a reentry advocacy day, and on my way back, I sat on the bus, and there were all these ex-cons who were there for their cause, for their own cause, and I sat down next to a man who sort of hesitantly moved his backpack, and that then started chatting to me right away and talked about how overly prepared he is for, you know, a simple one-day field trip, basically, like what he has in his backpack, and, you know, and he said, well, that's kind of what prison turns you into, you know, like someone who's kind of obsessed and like doesn't know what to prepare for in the free world, who's unfamiliar with the free world of like all these terrible things that could happen to you in the free world. So, you know, we started talking about that, and it became clear to me pretty quickly that Angel is someone who really likes to talk, and that Angel is someone who's like charming but who also has an edge. He didn't talk right away about his crime, or he only said like, I killed a friend in an argument. So he made me really curious, and he was someone, I have to say, who was fun to be around with. And then Angel became friends at the halfway house with Bruce and Adam, and you know, they related to each other, it appeared to me, because they had all committed you know, a horrific crime, and that's something they didn't need to talk about really, because they knew they had served 20 or 30 years in prison, so there was this mutual understanding of each other, for each other.
I think for a lot of people, halfway houses are somewhat mysterious. Can you talk about at the Castle, which seems to me a very optimistic name, you know, given the clientele that it serves, but talk about the expectations of residents, the services that they're offered, how long they typically stay?
It depends on how long they stay. I mean, it depends on a variety of factors. But so the Castle, I should say, is really, as far as halfway houses go, a very nice halfway house. It's located in West Harlem, right by the Hudson River, right across the street from a big park. It overlooks the park, actually, so there's a lot of greenery. It's a clean halfway house. You know, it appeared to me, from what I've seen, fairly professionally run. So, of course, you know, there's also some downfalls. People have to be drug tested every day. So there's this drug testing machine where you go in and you look into it, and it measures something about your eyes, your pupils, and then spits out these little receipts, and you have to sign in and out. And if you want to spend your weekend somewhere else, you need to get a weekend pass, you know, I guess from a caseworker or something. So, you know, and then at first, when you first arrive there, you're going to be in a, you know, I don't know, four-man room or something like that, or maybe six-man. It depends on how full they are at the time. And then you gradually work your way up to, you know, if you're lucky, a room, you know, one-man room. And how long, it depends how long. I mean, some people, you know, get their feet back on the ground quicker. You know, I think they're more tolerant towards people who are older, who have a harder time reintegrating into society.
That reintegration is a fascinating process after decades behind bars, because one thing that prison does is sort of infantilize anyone who is there to the extent that they make very few choices about anything in their lives.
Right. So when you get released from prison, decision-making becomes a major problem, like, because for the last 20 years, all the choices are made for you. So all of a sudden, you have to, there was this, you know, sort of funny example with Bruce, who bought a whole chicken, because I don't know why, but, you know, he liked to cook, and so he bought this chicken, and then the chicken just sat in his fridge, because he was like, I don't know, like, it needs to be sliced, how do you slice a chicken? So, like, very mundane things that are just second nature to you and I all of a sudden become this problem. And then also what's important to point out, so if you're confronted with this decision-making process, and it puts you under pressure. It provokes anxieties, obviously. You know, all of a sudden you have to deal with a lot of stuff you had never had to deal with. And I think it's those anxieties that are very, very rarely addressed in the process.
When somebody is released from prison, what kind of preparation have they had beforehand for reentry into society?
Again, it depends on the state you're in. It depends on the prison you're in. But generally, very, very little preparation, and that's kind of shocking. You know that there's religious organizations on the inside who have their prison ministries, and you know that sort of provide a safe space for people. You know, I think they have to go, in Attica at least, they had to go through some sort of short reentry program, but I didn't see that these programs really addressed the issues that people were struggling with once they got out. There's shockingly little therapy in prison that actually addresses some of the criminal behavior and the sort of the antisocial values that led to the crimes in the first place. So that's something, you know, if you're lucky, you find an organization that's willing to address these issues after your release. But I think you're very lucky if you find an organization like that.
So you were shocked when you learned that the person that Angel had killed when he was 18, he said he had killed a friend. It was actually a teenage girl.
Yeah, because he hadn't mentioned that to me. And I should mention, I mean, I met Angel maybe a couple of times before, and when I say meet, then I mean had, like, long conversations with him. I very rarely, as a journalist, do, Q&A kind of interviews. So I usually just spend time with people and wait to see what they bring up, what concerns them. But then at one point, it was pretty clear that, you know, I called Angel and said, let's go to the park, I bring some cake, and let's talk. And I think it was clear to both of us what we will be talking about, and I had my tape recorder on. And, maybe it was also my perception that I wanted this to be a guy that was killed, because, you know, as a woman, obviously you're vulnerable. So that I was very surprised when he said something to the extent of, oh, she pissed me off, or she did something, you know. And I was like, she was a girl. And so that was a big surprise for me. Yeah.
Did you feel afraid after that, even if you knew that, I mean, intellectually, that nothing was likely to happen to you?
No, I'm oddly fearless in situations like that. Although I should say that whenever I first schedule interviews with someone or time to spend time with someone, I make sure that I'm in a safe place. But you know, you can always be wrong, obviously. I mean, I had this situation once where I scheduled an interview in a sound studio and with someone who had a full-time job, you know, a white gentleman. I there was nothing really, like, over the phone to be afraid of. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm in the sound studio and I'm realizing this guy's really weird, and I'm, you know, nobody could hear me scream on the outside. I was by myself. I just chose that studio because I needed a quiet place to talk, and that was available. I don't think you can really tell necessarily by someone's past life whether this person is capable from committing a crime or...
My guest is journalist Sabina Heinlein. Her new book is called Among Murderers, Life After Prison. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Sabina Heinlein. Her new book is called Among Murderers, Life After Prison. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So of your three main subjects, Sabina, Adam was the oldest and had been convicted after essentially a movie theater robbery gone horribly wrong. And when you met him, his demeanor reminded you more of like a retired professor than an ex-con.
Right. I should also mention, I mean, there was something that brought me very close to Adam. He was the closest to me of the three guys that I followed for the 2 or 3 years. You know, he was very insightful and he was very calm, and he had really great observational skills. I mean, in regards to the outside world, in regards to what happens to people in prison, and in regards to himself. So he would never stop questioning himself, and which was also a burden. I mean, he took responsibility for his crime to an extent that probably harmed him almost, you know, because he was like so just guilt-ridden and sad, and also he had spent like such a long time in prison. But there were many things that I could really, really deeply relate to him in, you know, the sort of a heightened sense of perception, and also I think like we both are very sort of anxious characters, so we really connected. And I heard him speak at several advocacy reentry roundtables, and he's a great speaker, and you know he's very genuine, and you know what he does is just real. It's just really real. So yeah.
Yeah, his story really did. It felt like a life wasted. Like having made some really bad choices, he was behind bars for decades, and now he's pretty elderly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, and he was really, I think, looking after having spent such a long time in prison, because he wasn't only incarcerated for those 30 years. He was also incarcerated before that. He had served several sentences for robbery already. I think he already was in a youth reformatory as a teenager. And but for some reason, this time, like with this horrible event, this robbery gone wrong, where his accomplice shot two guards, and he was also tried and convicted for murder, it really changed his life, and it turned it around 180 degrees. But then he spent all this time in prison, and he came out, and he felt like, you know, he was sick, and he felt like he didn't really know how to make it up. And so one thing, you know, it was very important for him to find a woman and to fall in love with someone. That was, I felt like, the only thing that could make up for all this wasted time.
He was the only one of the three, and understand I'm not justifying his crime, but he was the only one of the three that didn't actually commit the murder physically himself. It was a robbery that he and accomplices had planned. Someone else shot these security guards. Do you think that also helped you look at him in a different way than the other two subjects?
Maybe, but I think it's more important. I mean, what I'm more interested in is how far someone has come. You know, and I think with Bruce, I mean, I think we were just like, Adam is much more like of an intellectual than Bruce is, you know, which, I mean, I'm not saying this to judge, but like there were certain things that I could connect to with Adam. And, you know, and Bruce, I think, also was very clear about like what he's going to share, and like always put up a little bit of a wall, which I totally understand. I don't think, you know, you have an obligation to share anything with a journalist, to be honest. But so like I felt like it was really with Adam that we shared certain qualities that were important to me in a human being. And you know, I have a correspondence with a prisoner who spent more than 40 years in prison now, here in New York State prison, and he committed like a very, very, very horrible crime. But there's something about like his remorse, you know, as he writes about his remorse to me, that really makes me believe that he's genuine about it, and it makes me like him as a human being. Mm.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And I was interested that Bruce, it's really important to him. He often will sort of say the name of his victim. It's important to him that that name gets remembered.
Right, right. And I very much respected that. And I made that a point of the book, that it is important to say something of your victim, whether it's the name. I mean, in Adam's case, he had these horrible hallucinations of his victims in his cell. I don't think it's the healthiest way to be reminded of your crime and to deal with your crime. But at the same time, it really showed me that something inside him really, really felt deeply about what he had done.
And Bruce had sort of the double challenge of, okay, now he's got a murder rap and he's out there trying to make his way in the world, and he happens to be very physically imposing.
Right, right. He's very tall. Bruce is, I think, 6'6" tall, and he's broad-shouldered, and he has a loud voice, and I'm sure like that physical appearance makes a huge difference in we all know that, like, how society perceives us based on the way we look, you know.
So the circumstances by which your three subjects were convicted and the crimes they committed were all quite different, although murder was involved in each. But I wonder what you've learned about sort of the nature of what's referred to in the book, I think, as street thinking in making such a crime even possible for people to imagine. I think a lot of people listening might have a hard time getting their heads around how anybody could respond so violently to any stressful situation.
And that's why I think it was important to make the crimes a part of the book. I'm not so convinced by like some reentry philosophies of like, we put the crimes behind us and we never look at them again, and we're new human beings and we call ourselves, formerly incarcerated individuals. I think, in order to process what you have done, I think you have to be very honest, and I think you have to address your crime. I think, it's great that you want to become another human being, and you will, but still, the crime will always sit with you.
Mm-hmm. And you were not as convinced, am I correct about this? Or talk about how you felt about Angel's sense of remorse. Was he sorry that he got caught, or was he sorry that he took another life?
No, I think Angel was not sorry that he got caught. And I think Angel realizes that prison has taught him a lot, and that he found this great friend and mentor, May, whom he met in some adult literacy program as an 18-year-old when he was first incarcerated, and that he learned to read and to write through her. And sadly, prison for him was actually the first safe environment where he ever found himself, or like safe-ish environment, we should maybe say, because he was a bedwetter before, and he said like it was in prison that he first stopped wetting his bed. But yet, since he was incarcerated as an 18-year-old, when he got out as a 48-year-old, he really was very determined to put everything behind him and to not talk much, not spend much time reminiscing about like the horrible things he had done in his past life. And he was supported in that also by the Quakers. He became a Quaker while he was in prison. And, the Quakers, I think, have this belief that we can change 100%. And so Angel worked very hard on this, what I call like a sustained narrative, that, there's like the past, and then like I went through this rehabilitative process, I became a Christian, and then now I don't really have to deal with the crime the way, Adam or Bruce deals with their crime. And I think he also, he was very media savvy, so he did a lot of interviews with a variety of publication and radio shows, and it was important to him, I think, to repeat that narrative of rehabilitation, which is a very different approach than Adam and Bruce had, which is interesting, I think, that they all had like very different approaches to their own rehabilitation.
What did you come to believe about what it means to truly be rehabilitated, to be truly repentant?
There's something that occurred to me while I was writing the introduction, and that was sort of rehabilitation at heart, and that we should really look at when we determine whether, you know, someone is being released from prison or what kind of services we offer that person, whether someone is rehabilitated at heart, and by that I mean sort of takes moral responsibility and is really, really capable of seeing why he did what he did and how to change his ways. And this is the unfortunate part in all this, that there aren't many services available for, you know, offenders and ex-offenders that teach them that, you know. And there's studies out there that actually say that, you know, very determined cognitive behavioral therapy conducted by people who are warm and genuine, well-supervised, well-educated, can actually help lower recidivism rate. And this kind of therapy has to be like an individualized approach. You can't just throw, you know, 20 or 30 ex-offenders or offenders into a class and teach them all the same thing. You have to really look at what their problems are and then respond to their problems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Sarah in Dallas who says, I have several inmates that I write to, mostly with very long sentences. What can friends and families do to help be supportive when concerns about how much things have changed are brought up?
In what way? Do you know what she means? In what way? How much?
I think she means over the passage of time, if and when individuals are released, how to help them sort of cope with their concerns about dealing with the outside world after a long incarceration.
You know, that's really interesting because I was just speaking about my prisoner pen pal up in Attica who's been in prison for 40 years, and I sent him my book, and one of his responses was that he wished I had, I mean, one very major one is that he said, oh, he's really depressed after reading it because he had always hoped if or when he ever gets released that, you know, he'll be out and the worst of all his problems are going to be over, and that he had all these fantasies about, like, what free life is about, and through my book he learned that some of these fantasies or most of these fantasies are an illusion. And I think it's important to sort of, you know, stay in touch with people, to write them, to send them articles, to involve them in the general discourse, like the political discourse or something. You'll be surprised how much people actually know. Then, of course, on the other hand, there are like these really odd assumptions that happen when you are in prison for 40 years and that need to be addressed also, but that are harder to address.
Do they stay in contact with the friends they made on the inside?
It depends. Adam tries to. He always said that his family in prison. He had his family in prison. Angel, I think a little bit, but not. I don't think it's his main concern right now. He's going to college. He's making new friends. He really wants to, I think, establish a different life.
There's an interesting ritual that you write about here that I had not been aware of, that when people who have been behind bars for a long time have their first birthday out in the world again, they consider that almost like their first birthday ever.
Yeah, because in prison, I guess people don't really celebrate their birthdays, and this is all like based, you know, I haven't done any studies about that, but this is all based on what people told me who were released from prison after 2007. There's the passing of time is so painful that that's the last thing you need to be reminded of, that you are once again another year older. So I think when we celebrated Angel's birthday, I asked him what he wants to do, and he said, I haven't really thought about it, and I was like, hey, well, why don't we go to a restaurant and take your best friend May along and make this a nice dinner celebration, and we took Adam and Bruce along, and so it was kind of like his first birthday on the outside. I mean, particularly in his case, because he was incarcerated when he was 18, he came from a very horrible background. He had a horrible childhood, very poor. I mean, all of my guys grew up in, like, horrible poverty. So it was really his first birthday, in a sense.
Did you ever have to sort of draw a professional line between being a journalist and covering their lives and being a friend to them? And was there ever a place where you weren't quite sure where that line fell?
I think it is complicated because in a way you do, as a journalist or with that kind of immersion journalism, you spend so much time with your subject that you do the same things you would do for a neighbor or friend. You know, you if they have something heavy to carry, you help them carry that, you know. But on the other hand, I think I was very clear at the beginning on drawing that line also. I mean, partially also because I was afraid that they would see me as their friends. And so I think they all saw that at some point the reporting of the book would be finished and then I would be writing, and Angel stayed in touch and still, you know, calls me every once in a while, and he came to my book launch event. But I think it's sort of clear that I'm not really a friend. I mean, that I'm doing this for different reasons.
We've been talking a lot lately in this country about whether we are incarcerating too many people. Do you think, I mean, what's the weight, and maybe we can set aside murder for purposes of this argument, but what's the weight between the damage done to an individual's future productivity with the need of society to isolate people who have committed crimes and to be sure that they don't commit more?
Well, I think one of the big problems is that we really need to redefine our stance in terms of, like, what we want the end product of incarceration to be. So do we want to deter people who are, you know, who might commit crimes in the future? This is an approach that hasn't really shown effective in studies. Do you just want to incapacitate and make sure that those people are not going to commit any more crimes? Or do you want to rehabilitate? And then, like, if you want to rehabilitate, and there are certain initiatives in this country now, like alternative to incarceration initiatives, especially, like, if it's, like, first-time offender, if it's, like, not murder, obviously, you know, if it's murder, then people go to prison. But, you know, if it's, like, you know, some 17-year-old robs some individual, like, maybe incarceration is not, like, the best response or the best first response. Maybe we first have to look at whether there's something we can actually do to help that individual, because just to lock him up without facilitating any types of programs and helping that person, you know, you let him back out after 10 years, and that's why we have, I think that's why we have at least partially such high recidivism rate.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Sabina Heinlein. Her book is called Among Murderers.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Sabina Heinlein. Her new book is called Among Murderers, Life After Prison. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So one of the things you did, Sabina, following these individuals around was to go to the classes that are available for parolees to sort of gain job skills and life skills. Can you talk about how those are set up and run and how helpful they are or are not?
Well, I visited classes in two different organizations. You know, one thing that I would like to sort of warn about is, I mean, there's this term, Edward Latessa, who's a famous criminologist, he was talking about correctional quackery, meaning, you know, classes and programs for offenders and ex-offenders that are not evidence-based, we're just like it's individuals who think they're gonna put them straight, and you know, and then often this is like based on humiliation, you know, sort of the boot camp approach, which has really never proven to be effective in reducing recidivism at all, like the scared straight program in prison where they bring kids behind bars and show them how prison life is in the hope that that's going to keep them from committing a crime. I mean, one of the problems of this class is, as I said earlier, you put like 20 ex-offenders in a class, and one is 18 and one is 60, 70, and one is an Asian who can barely speak English, and you know, one has committed murder and the other one, you know, has like a drug problem. I mean, this is all exactly the problem I was talking about, like in terms of individual treatment. Mm-hmm. You know, like to teach these people how to shake hands and to look into their employer's eyes when they go for an interview is not going to solve their antisocial behavior, or their, as they call it, the criminogenic risk factors. There's a very thin correlation between unemployment and recidivism, actually. And one thing that will always stick to me that Edward Tessa said to me in a phone interview is like, so if, you know, I asked him about that correlation, and he said, well, if you lost your job, would you go out and, I don't know what he said, rob a bank or something, you know? And I'm like, no, of course I wouldn't, you know, mm-hmm. because it's a matter of values and of integrity, really, and not a value of whether, you know, someone can hold down a minimum wage job or not.
Mm-hmm. And so the skills that they do need, are they provided at all by these programs, or are they things that ultimately, in your experience, people have to sort of learn for themselves?
I think there are certain things that are provided, yes. I think it is a good thing to know, if you go for an interview, to know how to present yourself, and if you need to be taught that, then maybe you need to be taught that in a class. What I did not like is, as I said, you know, the humiliation that [S2] Yeah. [S1] Often came with making mistakes. And then the fact that you build up people's hopes, like, so they go to these classes, they think they're going to be hooked up with a job afterwards, but, you know, a lot of them are basically unemployable, because who wants to hire a murderer? I mean, that's a huge problem. Like, people are being released, and, you know, today, like, every employer almost does a background check, and so if you know, this kind of offense shows up in your record, then you'll have a really hard time finding a job. And I think, you know, again, like, you build up people's hopes, and then you disappoint them, and I think this disappointment is something that should be avoided somehow.
How did these guys make decisions about when they would meet a new acquaintance who might not know their background? I mean, at what point do you tell the whole story? How much do you withhold, knowing that a surprise down the line might cause somebody to sort of run away frightened of you?
Right. I think we should ask, do we even want to know? Do most people even want to know what someone did? And that's something that kind of shocked me about society at large, that I think a lot of people really didn't want to talk about the crime, particularly, I mean, in this case, murder, because it's a sensitive issue. It's frightening.
So talk about I know one factor for some individuals in getting parole in the first place is having a place to live when they get out, having, you know, friends and relatives on the outside. How often are those things still available to people who've been away for 20 or 30 years?
It's very, very hard. I mean, Angel was first supposed to move in with his aunt, for example. So in order to be paroled, you need to show you have a place to live, a place to go to. I don't think you're just going to be paroled just out on the street. I mean, I know that, like, from jails, a lot of people are just being released and they don't have to really show an address or something. But if you've spent, like, 20, 30 years in prison, the parole board has an interest in you having, like, a steady place to stay. So it's a problem. Like, and also, I think a lot of relatives don't want to take people in with a criminal background because they might have, like, they have enough to deal with their own lives, maybe. That's why halfway houses are necessary. I don't know, I'm sure you have heard about that recent study up here in Pennsylvania about, you know, that halfway houses don't reduce recidivism. And I have to say, I would imagine it depends very much what kind of services the halfway house provides. I mean, if you just, you know, if it's like a dingy, dirty place to stay where you just get screwed over all the time and where people steal from you, it might not reduce recidivism, but if it's a place that connects you to, you know, again, cognitive behavioral therapy, where you have a case manager who genuinely cares for you and helps you deal with the burdens of being released after so many years in prison, there might very well something that might help you in the future.
One thing that, if you want to call it an advantage that Adam had was that of the three, he had some income from his late wife's Social Security benefits, so he didn't have to go out and find a job.
Right. It was very important for him to work. I mean, it was very, very important to him, and he eventually started to do like some sort of internship, I guess, where he got a stipend with one reentry organization, which is another interesting thing. So, like, the jobs that are available out there for people who have committed, you know, such immense crimes are often, again, within the reentry scene. So it's this almost like hermetic. Hermetically sealed microcosm that you can never escape because no one else is willing to hire you and is interested in your problems. But generally, I mean, I think meaningful work is important for anyone, like whether you've been in prison or not. You get like some government assistance right when you're released, but then it's tied to these classes. In exchange, you have to show that you do something productive. So often they send you to like these never-ending reentry and job readiness classes.
Did these guys understand why people who didn't choose to spend the time or didn't have the time to really get to know them as individuals would be frightened, would sort of recoil from them upon learning what they had done?
I know that Bruce definitely understood, and that was very much part of our dialogue, of our ongoing dialogue, that he felt that, you know, he had almost himself convinced that he can't trust himself because society can't trust him. So, you know, there was this one scene that's like a part of the book where we sit at the construction site late at night, and I interview him. I wanted to see him on the job working as a guard. He's guarding this construction site. He has a midnight shift, midnight from until 8 o'clock in the morning. So I visit him like at 1 o'clock in the morning to see what his work looks like. And he said, I can't understand that your husband lets you go out so late at night and hang out with the murderer. And I tried to explain to him that I'm not afraid of him because I know the circumstances of his crime. But it surprises him because society has a murderer convinced that he can never trust himself. So I thought that was interesting.
We have an email here from Suzanne who wants to know if you could suggest how to go about acquiring a prison pen pal.
There are several prison pen pal websites out there where prisoners are looking for contacts on the outside. I think if you just Google prisoner pen pals, you'll get several sites right away.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way for people to know whether, you know, if they're communicating with someone? I think a lot of people have a sense that they want to be empathetic. Is there a way to judge whether the person you've established contact with is truly remorseful, has truly changed, or is just looking for a little human contact? And how much should that matter to people who want to communicate with people behind bars?
It depends on what you're interested in. I mean, if you're interested in maybe also helping that person and helping them understand what happened to them or what they did, mm-hmm. Then, you know, you might very well make that part of the dialogue. In terms of like safety, I mean, what I did at the beginning when I started writing prisoners, I had a PO box, and now, you know, I'm just like in touch with this one prisoner, or like actually a couple, but I trust them enough to give them my home address to write me letters. I, you know, it depends on like whether you trust your people skills, so to speak. Yeah.
Did you find that people you described this project to while you were working on it, did everyone sort of understand what you were trying to do, or were there people who said, why would you write about people who have done such terrible things?
No, I actually didn't have that encounter. I had the encounter afterwards that people didn't seem to really understand what kind of book this is going to be, and now that people are reading the book, they're surprised that it isn't really a public policy book at all, that it's like a work of literary nonfiction that pays a lot of attention to detail and to scene, and like has extensive dialogue and, you know, really tries to emphasize the human struggle of all this.
How did the project change you?
I mean, if anything, it made me more empathetic, you know, and then, of course, I learned a lot about people I had no idea about, and I think that's always a good thing. You know, I've always been driven by sort of this curiosity and this need to see how other people live and manage their lives, how people overcome obstacles, it's just, I mean, it's just fascinating to me. And it helps with, you know, and still, I mean, helping with that fascination.
You've been living in the U.S. for more than a decade now, but I wonder if, given, you know, our global reputation for putting a lot of people in prison, if working on this gave you an understanding of U.S. culture that was broader than what you might have had simply living and working here on other things.
Yeah. Although I have to say that I don't really know anything, or like not a very, very little about criminal justice in Germany, where I was raised. Mm-hmm. So this was really an entirely new topic to me. What I have to say is, in general, as a foreigner, an immigrant coming to this country, it's almost like looking through a magnifying glass in a lot of ways, that, you know, you're so used to everything in your own country. It's like sort of routine, and then you come to a new country and you see sort of these discrepancies, for example, you know, the adversity, the huge gap between rich and poor in this country. So I think it's like sort of magnified for me as someone from the outside looking in.
That's interesting, because yeah, if one is raised within the society, that wealth gap, it may be regrettable, but it's something that we've always known and doesn't strike us as so odd.
Right. You don't, it's almost like you don't maybe feel it the way you should feel it. And I felt like here, coming here, I really felt it. But then, of course, I was also specifically looking at a population that is particularly, you know, that struggles immensely.
Were there any scenes that actually made it into the book that you debated with yourself over whether to put in?
I debate with myself all the time, like with every single scene. Uh-huh. So once I had made the final decisions, I was confident that this was the right decision. There were maybe a couple of scenes that I would have liked to include in the book, and I didn't include them, but that was more a matter of space and what my publisher thought is important.
Sabina Heinlein has written for the Iowa Review, the Brooklyn Rail, and Tablet Magazine. Her new book is called Among Murderers, Life After Prison. Sabina, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about what we have coming up, and you can download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.